These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled, A Brief History of the World, Part 2. Lecture 13, Post-Classical Trade and Contacts.
Our discussion today focuses on the development of new kinds of contacts, particularly trade contacts, in the post-classical period. I've already argued in introducing the post-classical period that the new range and intensity of contacts was, along with the spread of world religions, one of the really crucial developments in this period, affecting most parts of Asia, many parts of Africa, many parts of Europe. There was no single heroic event in this proliferation of contacts. We're talking really about the efforts of literally hundreds and thousands of traders, some inventors, some craftsmen, certainly a lot of manufacturers, but the process can seem a little abstract. So what I'd like to do in illustrating this crucial development is first talk about one of the interesting byproducts of the new patterns of contact in the emergence of a new set of world travelers. That'll allow some personal faces on the phenomenon. Then we'll turn back to the major routes themselves, and then, and this is the most important part, talk about so what? What were the consequences of this contact? Why make such a big fuss about it? In the 14th century, one of the greatest, perhaps the greatest, single world traveler emerged by name of Ibn Battuta. Battuta was born in Morocco in northwestern Africa. He grew up in a what we might call middle-class merchant family, reasonably prosperous, received a legal education, and launched his travels, as did so many Muslims, first by participating in the great, highly recommended, obligatory if possible, pilgrimage to Mecca. Battuta obviously crossed North Africa going to Mecca, and he already showed his travel thirst by not just visiting Mecca, but by visiting other parts of the Eastern Mediterranean, Palestine, Jordan, etc. In his lifetime, Battuta would travel over 75,000 miles. Almost certainly the longest trip any single individual, the longest set of trips any single individual had ever undertaken in world history. That's a lot of miles. He went by foot. He went on donkey. And the importance of donkeys in carrying world contacts at this point cannot be underestimated. He went occasionally on ship. He used virtually every known means of conveyance, but he undoubtedly spent a great deal of time in motion. His travels would take him not just frequently back to the pilgrimage, to other parts of North Africa and the Middle East. They took him to Persia. They took him well into Central Asia, where he frequently traveled over mountain passes in winter, enduring a number of harrowing adventures in the process. He spent a good bit of time in India, particularly in the Delhi Sultanate, where he actually at one point had an official position. He traveled to island groups in the Indian Ocean. He traveled to Southeast Asia. He traveled to China, which, as we will discuss further in a moment, he didn't actually like too well. He then went back after a long series of journeys. He then went back to North Africa, but was still insatiable. And in what we could regard as central or even slightly later middle age, undertook a final set of trips into sub-Saharan Africa, particularly into the great kingdom of Mali. He wrote up his travels, which is obviously why we know so much about them, and his account both reflects the new range of geographical contact possible and also encouraged this kind of contact, because people read Battuta, they could seek to imitate him, they could develop a thirst for learning about new places from his accounts. His motivations for travel seem to have been several. He was certainly religiously inspired. He was a faithful Muslim, and much of his travel, indeed most of it, centered on territories that were fully or partly converted to Islam, where he could feel comfortable, where he could maintain contact with his religious rituals. His travel was sometimes probably sexually motivated. He writes rather self-satisfiedly about some sexual exploits during his travels. He frequently picked up consorts and short-lived spousal relationships, and sometimes he probably left because these relationships deteriorated. But above all, he was clearly driven by a massive curiosity about strange places, even though often Muslim, still nevertheless strange. His reactions, in addition to illustrating the new potential for geographical expression of human curiosity, his accounts reflect a couple of other features that are worth noting. He judged according to the standards of Islam. In places that were Muslim, but not exactly like the Middle East and North Africa, he would praise their religious piety. This particularly applies to his reactions to some of the African societies he visited. He would praise their piety, but deplore departures from the norm. For example, he worried greatly that many African women seemed to wear fewer clothes than they should by Middle Eastern standards and seemed to have a social presence, a confidence in public assertions in social settings that he found disturbing. In his one clear venture well outside Islam, his visit to China, he professed himself, and it's a really interesting passage, he professed himself almost clearly uncomfortable. He knew that China was a great society. He praised Chinese cities, architecture, etc., but he said he stuck to his room a lot because without the presence of an Islamic overlay, this was just a little bit disorienting. Another great traveler of the post-classical period, actually a little earlier than Ibn Battuta, was of course Marco Polo, the great Venetian traveler who presumably went to China under Mongol rule and reported elaborately on what he found there. A brief caveat. We are not absolutely sure that Marco Polo went. His uncles clearly visited China, but he may have used their accounts plus Persian travel literature to fabricate a version of his own travels, among other things glorifying his personal exploits. We're simply not absolutely sure. The odd thing is he fails to mention certain features of China that you'd think he would have found really quite noteworthy. For example, the foot binding of many Chinese women in the cities. So we're not absolutely sure. But if Marco Polo didn't do it, other Europeans clearly did. Their travels were somewhat less wide-ranging than Ibn Battuta's, though the travelers to China sometimes came back via the Indian Ocean and therefore encountered South and Southeast Asia as well as East Asia. But the European travelers, if Marco Polo is taken as illustrative, differed from Ibn Battuta in one respect. They were less uncomfortable in settings outside their religious orbit. They almost had to be less uncomfortable because Christianity had spread less widely. They could not have expected a cultural umbrella that would frame them as a Muslim could expect. But if you put the two cases together, Ibn Battuta, Marco Polo, or the Polos, you have an active sense of the new extent to which people could visit distant places, did visit distant places, developed a thirst for travel adventure, and in their ensuing accounts, Marco Polo's book, for example, was on Christopher Columbus's bookshelf somewhat later on, by their accounts, spur other people to seek trade activities, contact activities that would push them also into the unknown, or at least the less known. Travel, of course, was interesting, and it's very clear that travel in this period differed greatly from the kinds of travel that had been possible in the earlier classical era. The travelers travel farther, they encounter far more different kinds of situations, and their accounts are much more consistently accurate than accounts of earlier travelers like Herodotus, who simply made things up or accepted fabulous stories when he went beyond his actual travel range. This is a different kind of travel. It reflects a different kind of world. The actual contact patterns need to be further embellished as well. As I noted earlier, the core root for this new pattern of contact that emerged in the post-classical period, the core root was an Indian Ocean route connecting Western Asia or the Middle East, the Arab territories, the Persian territories, under Islam now, connecting these territories with South Asia, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific coast of China. This was a series of routes initially forged by Arab merchants primarily, but soon joined by Muslims and others from India, from Southeast Asia, and elsewhere, and also a number of Persians. This was a series of routes that carried a variety of goods. Particularly important were manufactured goods from China, silk, of course, but now also porcelain and some other products, and spices that were available from Southeast Asia or India. This was an Asian-centered trade pattern, and it had the interesting effect, and here we begin to see the new importance of these kinds of contacts. It had the interesting effect of spurring major manufacturing expansions, particularly in China. In China, during the Song Dynasty, which opened up in the later 10th century, some historians have actually referred to a Chinese Industrial Revolution. I think the term's a little misleading. We don't want to confuse it with industrialization later on. But there's no question that China was becoming, in this period, something of a world manufacturing powerhouse, a status which the nation seems to be recovering in our own day. Other routes, of course, fed into the East-West contact. Three patterns were particularly important. Two routes, as we've noted previously, two routes connected sub-Saharan Africa to this East-West trade and carried African goods not just into the Middle East and North Africa, but into other parts of Asia as well. The easiest route, the one that most clearly linked with the East-West corridor, was the coastal route that stretched up the Swahili coastline, the Swahili trading cities that developed along the coast and on the islands of East Africa. But West African trading activities, merchants from places like Ghana and Mali, also participated actively in interregional trade, using camels and horses to cross the Sahara, and seeing North African traders come down to participate directly as well, as traders and once in a while as raiders. So link number one were the connections that linked various parts of sub-Saharan Africa to the North African Middle Eastern end of the East-West route. From Africa came a variety of goods, gold, slaves, exotic animals, certain other kinds of animal and vegetable products that fed a considerable trade, particularly with the Middle East, but also sometimes beyond. And handfuls of African slaves even showed up in post-classical China, where one can speculate about what the Chinese made of these people, and above all, what these people themselves made of their experience in such a different kind of environment. Another feeder route developed beginning in the 8th and 9th centuries, from Scandinavia through what is presently Western Russia and Ukraine, passing through the great city of Kiev, on its way to the Byzantine Empire, and from there connecting with Arab trade as well. Scandinavian traders coming down through Russia may actually have given Russia its name, from the Scandinavian word for red, the red hair that many of these traders had. We don't know that for sure, but it's at least possible. But there's no question that this East Central European north-south route was a vital one for the region itself, and as it contributed, products and merchant activity to the larger East-West flow. Slightly later and more gradually, Western Europe also connected with this trade route as merchants from England, the Low Countries, and France began to come down either overland or along the Atlantic coast to the Mediterranean, where they could directly reach into Middle Eastern areas in the Eastern Mediterranean, Egypt, etc. An example of this kind of merchant activity was the famous French merchant of the 15th century, Jacques Coeur, who was an advisor to French kings, a moneylender, but also who frequently traveled to the Middle East in search of products that would sell widely back home. He was just one of many European traders, French, obviously Italian, and many others, who made considerable fortunes and sometimes lost them as well in their connections with this new kind, new level of international commercial activity. Jacques Coeur, ironically, disgraced in his later life, died on a crusade directed presumably against Islam and in favor of Christian reconquest of the Holy Land. A major set of routes then stretched from the Middle Eastern center to various parts of Asia. It was connected to much of Africa and a good bit of Europe, both East Central and West, and the combination provided a series of activities that really had no previous precedent in world history. What were the results? Why make such a fuss about this? A number of results developed from these trading patterns that were important at the time and that also set precedents for later activity. I've mentioned one already. The extent to which this level of interregional trade could now have a major impact on internal economies, particularly the economy of China, was already an effect of no small magnitude. Some areas of the world, again, particularly in China, began to orient a good bit of their economic activity toward production for what we would today call world markets. New kinds of consumer dependence developed as well. We don't usually think of post-classical societies as consumer societies, and in a modern sense, they weren't. But very clearly in this period, and there had been hints of it earlier along the Silk Roads, very clearly in this period, certain elements of the upper classes in a number of societies developed tastes for goods that could be only supplied from distant regions. A clear example occurred in Western Europe during and after the Crusades. The Crusades began in the later 11th century. As West Europeans, particularly noblemen, participated in the Crusades, they learned of higher living standards that were common in Middle Eastern cities, and they developed a taste for some of the resultant products. A particularly interesting example that would motivate a tremendous amount of European activity from this point onward into the 19th century, a case in point is sugar. Post-classical Europeans traditionally had sweetened their products with honey, which actually strikes me as quite sensible and quite pleasant. But for whatever reason, and I cannot pretend to know why, they like sugar better. Well, they couldn't make it at home. So they begin an obvious and consistent effort to acquire access to more regular supplies of sugar, initially still for the upper classes. This is not yet a mass taste, although it will become one. And this kind of consumer attachment obviously helped feed the activities of many merchants, both European and Asian. It helped spur new kinds of shipping activities in the Mediterranean that would link Europe to Middle Eastern ports where products could be transshipped from other parts of Asia. This kind of a consumer attachment was itself a major variable in world history from this point onward. Not all societies developed equal levels of susceptibility to consumer needs. China, for example, which had an elaborate urban consumer culture in the post-classical period, needed far fewer products from the outside world than did Western Europe. China did need to trade with Southeast Asia, particularly for certain kinds of tea, but their needs otherwise were limited. So China would see a much greater effort to seek from world trade other kinds of products than personal consumer items, products such as exotic animals for zoos, handfuls, not masses, but handfuls of slaves, and particularly precious metals. As these goods moved along the new trade routes in response to the supply of Chinese manufactured products. New kinds of economic impact, new kinds of consumer attachments, even dependence on international trade. A third item, obviously, were new levels of culture contact. Some of this involves simply a matter of word exchange from one language to the next. a large number of words began to pass into European languages from Arabic, denoting the kinds of products that were now being transshipped from other parts of the world to Europe. Terms like orange, for example, or sugar itself. Arabic words translated into the major European languages because these were the words that described initially what the products themselves were. But other kinds of cultural exchange were obviously even more important. Particularly noteworthy was the extent to which what Europeans called the Arabic numbering system came into wide use in this period. This system had itself been developed in classical India. It was not Arabic, but the Arabs had taken it over from the Indians, and Europeans and others would in this period take it over from the Arabs, providing what is still the most efficient numbering system ever developed in the world, a numbering system that now began to gain what we would today call some real international currency. Mathematical systems could spread more widely. Algebra, another Arabic word and Arabic mathematical innovation, algebra began to spread from the Arab world to other societies, including Europe. Not surprisingly, then, new levels of commercial contact spurred other kinds of cultural interaction, even across what otherwise seemed major religious barriers, i.e., for example, the barrier between Islam and Christianity. Technologies were impacted by new levels of world trade in two ways. First, a number of new technologies were introduced during the post-classical period deliberately to facilitate new kinds of trading activities, particularly new kinds of seagoing commercial activities. Ship design improved. The Arabs introduced significant developments in sailing ships, particularly making them more appropriate for use in the Indian Ocean. Toward the end of the post-classical period, the Chinese introduced gigantic ocean-going vessels, the Chinese junks, with huge hulls and huge carrying capacity that they began to use from the Song Dynasty onward to link eastern China with the Indian Ocean trade routes. In addition to new ship design, obviously new navigational devices emerged. The compass was almost certainly invented in China, possibly initially not for use by travelers, but to help the Chinese arranged their domestic furnishings appropriately according to the principles of feng shui. But whether this story is entirely accurate or not, the navigational use of the compass was quickly realized, and the Chinese used the compass increasingly in their own commercial activities, and from the Chinese, the compass would spread to Southeast Asia, to the Middle East, and to Europe, where in a number of its transmissions, the device was also improved, particularly for shipboard use. Other navigational devices in the period included the astrolabe, which helped ships locate themselves according to the night sky. A number of devices facilitated navigation, and obviously this is both a consequence of heightened levels of interregional trade and, again, an encouragement to further levels of trade. The second technological impact of this new level of contact involves transmission. Not surprisingly, although still slowly by contemporary standards, not surprisingly, new levels of contact help societies learn about inventions that had initially been introduced elsewhere more quickly than had previously been the case. Technological diffusion was not new. Agriculture, iron use, etc., had previously spread from one area to another. But now the process is accelerated and in some cases made much more deliberate than had been the case earlier. An interesting example, which also I admit shows the continuing limitations on the process, an interesting example was paper. Paper was a product that had been invented in classical China and not used widely outside of China at that point. The utility of paper in China as a society that was particularly bureaucratic can't escape notice, but the fact is this was a major technological invention that could greatly facilitate communication. Arabs learned about paper in their military interactions in Western China in the 8th and 9th centuries. They captured a number of Chinese and took them back to the Middle East. They discovered that a couple of them knew how to make paper, and they put them to work setting up the first paper manufacturing operation in the Middle East proper, as I say, in the 8th and 9th centuries. Western Europeans would learn about paper from their contact with the Arabs, and the first European paper factory was established in Sicily, reasonably close to the Middle East, in the very early 1200s. Now again, this is not lightning transmission. You're talking about several centuries between Arab utilization of paper and West European imitation from the Arabs. But nevertheless, this is a lot faster that we've seen major technologies transmitted heretofore, and we will have other examples in subsequent sessions of technological transmissions during the post-classical period that were more rapid still. Economic impact, consumer tastes, cultural exchanges, technological diffusion, all of these added up to a significant set of consequences of environmental factors surrounding the new level of interregional contacts. And the final point in talking about consequence really sums up the growing utility that various societies in Asia, Africa, and Europe found in maintaining or increasing their commitment to these international activities. The fact was that the utility of international activities or interregional connections was so obvious at this point that some kind of interregional system would survive disruptions and changes in the original system itself. Most obviously, as we noted in a previous discussion, the Arab capacity to sustain major initiatives in the interregional arena began to decline in the 12th and 13th centuries. Arabs remain involved. Other Muslims from the Middle East and South Asia continued to participate strongly, but the international apparatus could have tumbled, at least for a while, as Arab capacity diminished, as Arab political and cultural vitality dwindled to some extent. But the system was simply too precious to abandon. And as the Arab sustaining of the system yielded to other entrants, the clear result was a continued commitment, a continued capacity to sustain interregional contacts, either along the established trade routes or on alternative routes that would develop precisely because of this new level of commitment, this new understanding of resulting benefits. The post-classical period, particularly as interregional connections developed and solidified by 1000 CE onward, this has been seen, as we discussed previously, as one of the real watersheds in world history, the point at which many societies in Afro-Eurasia turned from an emphasis on largely separate developments with connections with other regions, a peripheral activity at best, turned from this focus on the local and regional to an increasing focus on the benefits of connections, the possibilities of imitation, the possibilities of diffusion. And this was a pattern that would then, once the tipping point occurred, continue to accelerate from this juncture onward. There's another way to make the same point, and I do this tentatively, but it's worth consideration. There is a fairly straight line from the interregional connections that developed in the post-classical period to what we now view as globalization. Now, lots of apologies. Contemporary globalization is a lot quicker. It involves a lot greater volume in terms of trade connections. It involves far more extensive cultural interactions. So the post-classical period does not introduce globalization in the contemporary sense. But the straight line aspect is nevertheless noteworthy. People who traded and traveled and wrote about their activities in the post-classical period, helped inspire people who would extend interregional trading activities still further later on, people like Christopher Columbus. And they, in turn, would feed great trading companies, new technologies that would spur travel and trade still further in the 19th century and on to contemporary globalization. There are historians, and we'll encounter them later in the course, there are historians who will argue this evolutionary approach, a pattern of interregional connections from the post-classical period blossoming steadily and gradually into globalization, that this is a wrong view. Globalization, in their eyes, is a much newer phenomenon, and we will have to deal with that. But remember this possibility. This is why the post-classical explosion of trade and travel really looms so large in world history. It's a different world by the 11th and 12th centuries in terms of the impact and involvement of many people, merchants, consumers, upper class leaders, the involvement of many people in a dependence on and enjoyment of contacts with distant places.